Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. So we are back on our regular schedule Wednesday. The move was completed a week ago today, so back with two pods tomorrow. Mr. Executive Director John Murray will join me. But first, we're going to return an old friend, Paul Stone, handicapper, who does a great job. But before we do that, I want to remind everyone to check out another ESPN podcast that will help you with your fantasy football teams. Make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
Time now to welcome a friend of the program, a gentleman who's been on the podcast a few times before last college football season. He's back for more. Paul Stone, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well down here in Texas, Doug. Good to be with you guys and looking forward to another weekend of college football.
Yeah, I know. So I moved to Las Vegas, so we're going to connect pretty soon as you fly in. And you're hardcore because you fly into Vegas, I want to say most weekends or all weekends. You can clarify in a sec. But, you know, you fire on games, and then Sunday morning you bet the openers and then fly back ignoring the NFL, which I give you a lot of respect for.
Yeah, I mean, this time of the year, I come out every weekend and usually arrive on Friday and watch games there in Vegas on Saturday and then return on Sunday, betting the openers there late Saturday morning at the Circus. So it's a, you know, it gets to be a little bit tedious and, you know, stay tired. But we all know how that goes. The college football season only comes around once a year. So it's a labor of love, and I really enjoy doing it and really appreciating the Circa, you know, coming out and stepping out and being the market maker for college football openers each Sunday.
Well, we on the podcast appreciate someone who's all in on college football, not 50-50. So that's great here. Since you are in Texas and you have the Texas twang, we got to start with the Red River rivalry because I want to know, you know, I have a good friend who follows Oklahoma pretty intensely, and he's like, I don't know why OU's favorite. Maybe that's just a little bit of, you know, the bitter pill talking after back-to-back losses for the Sooners because the Texas D hasn't exactly looked good. Short number here. We usually see it like a battle of undefeateds in early October for this rivalry, but obviously some of the sparkle is gone here with how they've performed so far. But what do you make of this this short number here?
Yeah, I mean, it's been the same, Doug, pretty much all summer. Back in early June, the MGM, they posted some college football games of the year, and I actually came out for those as well. And the line there was Oklahoma -2.5, and it's pretty much stayed in that range, you know, for the last, I guess, now 4 months. So I think it's, you know, where it needs to be. I actually made it, you know, I make numbers before I go to the circuit each Sunday. I actually made it -1. Oklahoma. So I think, you know, I think Oklahoma, just the fact that they've been the class of the conference, they're going to be a small favorite, but it's just such an odd situation to be talking about these two teams in these terms as they enter this Red River rivalry. I mean, you've got Oklahoma facing the prospect of going 0-3 in conference. And, you know, if not for a frenetic rally against Texas Tech 2 weeks ago, the Longhorns will be in the same boat. I lean ever so slightly to Texas on the side, you know, plus the 2.5. But if somebody, you know, wants to get involved here, I would more highly recommend probably playing over 72, you know, even though the total is high. I just don't think either team can slow down the other's downfield passing game. You know, they're both weak, to be blunt about it, in the back 4 or 5. In coverage, they don't get a whole lot of pressure on the quarterback, either team, so far. So it's just difficult not to envision a whole lot of points. So I think if you want to get involved with this one, maybe the over would be the best position to take here.
Yeah, I mean, I know the number is huge. It's hard to make a case for the under, all things considered, given what we've seen so far. Now, I know you have some solid plays I want to get into, but I do want to pick your brain on some of the marquee games. And let's start the SEC. Tennessee, Georgia. I was looking. Something I've tried to add to my game this year is the look-ahead spot. I've done it in the past, but this is stuff I'm really looking for. It even more pronounced is the sandwich spot. We talked about it with the Chiefs a couple weeks ago facing the Chargers. So you had the big opener against the Texans, season opener. And then after the Chargers, you had the game against Baltimore on Monday night on the road, high-profile game to say the least. And that was a classic sandwich spot. This strikes me as one for Tennessee. Obviously, Georgia – sorry, in terms of betting on Tennessee, because Georgia last week had Auburn, right? And then next week has Bama in what might be the game of the year. So I want to play Tennessee here, but I just think the number's too sharp. It's the right number, 12 and a half.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. You know, I made this actually 14, so I think it's a little bit short too. You know, the Volunteers probably would be the side, but, you know, getting less than 14, even getting less than 13, it just doesn't seem like, you know, quite enough points. You know, last week looking at these teams, it was only one game, but Stetson Bennett the fourth, you know, he solved Georgia's quarterback woes, at least for one week, had a really steady performance in the Dogs' convincing win over Auburn. And Kirby Smart again, you know, some have criticized his game management, I guess you would be the way to put it, but there's no questioning Kirby Smart's ability to recruit, especially defensive players. They've got another great defense there in Athens. And obviously have a big one coming up next weekend at Alabama. For Tennessee, I think this game's really a measuring stick game. This is Jeremy Pruitt's third year there in Knoxville. Important to note, I think, that they've lost to Georgia the last three seasons by a combined 96 points. None of those games, rather, closer than 26 points. This game's going to be closer than that on Saturday. The question becomes, though, how much closer? And I'm like you, I'm just not really comfortable getting involved here. It's going to be a great game to watch, and I'll have great interest in it, but I won't be involved in it from a betting standpoint.
Yeah, I don't think Tennessee's there. I don't think they're like smart enough. I don't think they play like within their lane well enough. I think they have speed. I think they have athleticism. I think they can make big plays. But when you play an opponent like Georgia, especially in Athens, you have to play four full quarters. And I know you only have to cover here. You don't have to win. But this game can get away from you when you play reckless is the wrong word. But there's not – you have to have measured possessions. You have to be purposeful. And, yes, Kirby's got some shaky game decisions over the years, obviously SEC title games. But that defense will just pounce if you make any sort of sloppiness. You turn yourself into third and long and things like that. That's when they get you. And I don't think Tennessee is disciplined and consistent enough to kind of give me comfort to back them.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, you know, Jarrett Garantano, Tennessee's quarterback, he's been scrutinized, you know, maybe fairly, maybe unfairly. I think he's had some really good moments. And, this season and a season where Tennessee has everything still in front of it, you know, if there was ever a game for him to make his mark in Knoxville, a breakthrough game with breakthrough performance, it would be Saturday against the Dogs of Georgia there in Athens. So I think Garantano, he's the player that you're really going to have to expect, in my mind, to really elevate his play. And I don't know to this point if he's done anything really to merit that type of confidence. So I think Georgia's going to get to him off, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of game he has statistically wise and from a decision-making standpoint as well.
This might be a live wagering thing. The place was the sidelines were rocking, so to speak. The place wasn't because of the fans. But I think Georgia was up for last week. I'm worried about this game with Bama on deck, so I think I'm going to kind of need the eye test on this one, some live wagering. Speaking of Alabama, I don't think there's a look-ahead spot here, given it's Lane Kiffin and they're on the road. I just think it's a little bit more conducive. Now, with that being said, it still could be a flat spot. Maybe late Saban wants to get out of Oxford and just hit the road and maybe pulls his foot off the gas, which always comes into play with a line like 24. But for me, I need to wait until like Friday for the weather, given what's headed towards that region of the United States. But I'm looking at side Bama and over, and I find it hard to believe I can lose both. And I'm more likely to go 2-0 than I am 1-1. I might just do team total, but I got to wait on the weather. Because I think Alabama, I've really been impressed with Mac Jones. I was not impressed a year ago when he came in against Tennessee. Obviously, a much different situation. He's had an offseason. He's developing rapport with these wide receivers. He's been on the money
I love what he's been doing. And I don't see how Ole Miss stops him at all, but I do like Lane Kiffin on the headset calling some plays against being able to score here.
Yeah, I tell you, Doug, I mean, you hit one thing on the nail that we've got to have in our toolboxes as handicappers. College football season comes in the heart of hurricane season. And if you're not an amateur meteorologist as a college football handicapper, I think you're missing the boat. And the rain, not only this game, but games throughout the deep south and the southeastern part of the U.S., you really need to be watching. I use weather.com, their hourly forecast, and some other sites as well. But weather.com is pretty accurate. Still 3 days out, it's hard to know exactly how this hurricane is going to hit and how much it's going to impact which areas. But right now, I'm seeing an 80% chance of rain there in Oxford during the day and 70% at night. Winds could gust up to 35 miles per hour in the day. Scheduled to kick off there in Oxford at 5 p.m. Central. So everybody out there who's going to get involved in this game or has an interest in this game needs to be watching those weather reports. You look at that Ole Miss defense. They gave up 51 points in Lane Kiffin's debut 2 weeks ago at Florida. The Gators passed for 446 yards in that game, almost 10 yards per attempt. And then last week, although they won by 1 point at Kentucky in overtime, thanks in part to a missed extra point by the Wildcats in overtime, the Rebels allowed 41 points to the Wildcats. Kentucky rushed for 408 yards, 7.3 yards per carry. Alabama, obviously really good at both running the ball and passing the ball. So, you know, what do we set the Tides total yards offense at against the Rebels? Maybe 650 or so if the weather's good. And like you said, the team total, which looking at the current line of 23.5 and the total of 70.5 would project to be around the neighborhood of 47 anyway. I did play on Monday when the hurricane looked like it might have an impact. I played the under 74. And it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit of a precarious situation when you're projecting 5 days out, because these things do take turns and they come earlier, they come later, or they're not as significant as an impact weather-wise as maybe initially anticipated. But this will be an interesting one to watch. And I think, like you indicated, if it is dry weather, if it's good conditions, it's hard to think that Alabama or the over, one or both, wouldn't come in.
Yeah, the team total is going to be around 49. Maybe it's a first half team total too. Although you get one bad like holding call and you get a punt. Maybe if you don't get the opening kickoff, it's like, oh God, it's going to be hard to get a high number. So that's a dangerous territory to get. There's another SEC game that you are actually on. So instead of just picking your brain, we're going to get some plays here. And that is Florida and A&M. I'm so sick of Jimbo and all this. Now, I believe you're on the dog here, and I just can't be on the Aggies. Tell me why you're on A&M.
Well, you know, first of all, sometimes I look towards a team when others are looking away. That can be dangerous, but it can be profitable as well. You look at this Texas A&M, and they've been relatively unimpressive in their first two games. They narrowly escaped a conference bottom dweller in Vanderbilt at home in their opener. And then last week, they give up 52 points and 544 yards and a 4-touchdown loss in Tuscaloosa. So A&M's power rating definitely lower than it was before the season started. Then you look at Florida. Florida's defeated two Southeastern Conference opponents to start the season. Mississippi and South Carolina beat both of those teams by 2 touchdowns or more. The Gators currently ranked 3rd in the coaches poll, clearly a player in the college football playoff picture. So Florida's power rating, even though it was high to begin the year, it's gone up. So A&M stock's down. Florida's is up. You look at the Gators' offense, first of all, quarterback Kyle Trask, tight end Kyle Pitts. They have a lot of other talented skill players. They are really good offensively. However, I think they have some chinks in their defensive armor. They lost a lot of key players in the front seven from a year ago, guys like Jonathan Grenard, David Reese, Jabari Zuniga, just to name a few. Mississippi in the opener against Florida threw for 443 yards, 13.5 yards per attempt against Florida. I think A&M's quarterback, Kellen Mond, is going to have some success. He had success throwing the ball at some level against Alabama last week. He threw for 335 yards against the Tide. I think he's going to have even more success Saturday against Florida and College Station. And Pitts, important to note, keep an eye on this guy. Pitts is not the only talented tight end that will be on the field in College Station on Saturday. The Aggies' 6'5", 260-pound tight end Jalen Weidermeyer had 8 catches for 82 yards last week. One of Mon's favorite targets. I think he's a blossoming star in the SEC. I'd rather, you know, looking at the home dog here, I'd rather have a full house of 100,000 plus at Kyle Field from A&M's perspective. I only expected to have a limited audience of about 25,000. Florida, again, a little overpriced in my opinion. A&M and Jimbo really getting raked over the coals, rather here in Texas and nationwide for that matter. So I'm going to look where others are looking away. I'll recommend being a critical consumer. I think if you shop around, you can still find some 7. Take the Aggies and take the points over Florida Saturday in College Station.
All right, bold man, stronger stomach than I got, but you certainly make a case. I'm not laying it with Florida. I just don't think they're there yet. That Ole Miss first half should have been a lot tighter. In fact, Lane Kiffin going into halftime was asked that. He said, this is ridiculous. We're putting up all these yards. So I think Florida's sparkle's a little too bright right now, but I just can't get I think just Jimbo and it's a disaster. I don't think Mon's that good, but we'll see. We'll see. I have a play in the SEC. I actually have 2 plays, same game. And before we get to some other plays you have, I like Kentucky at home -2. I think things have definitely gone, you know, all the coin flip situations have gone against them. We know about the end of the first half in that Auburn game. And I was on the Tigers and I was celebrating it. But, you know, that game could have unfolded differently. I think their defense is playing well. I think they'll follow the script on how to limit this Leach team and Leach offense. I think under 58 and Kentucky -2 are 2 plays I like.
Yeah, I actually played Kentucky -2, so I'll be with you on that ticket there, Doug. You know, like Oklahoma in the Big 12, you've got a Kentucky team that I really like coming into the year, and they're staring the potential reality of an 0-3 start in conference play, you know, squarely in the eyes when Leach and that air raid offense come to town on Saturday. And again, we talk about the weather. You know, it's, again, 3 days out, but you've got a 60% chance for rain there in Lexington, So that's correct. But some of them possibly are going to be heavier storms. The air raid likely would get grounded a little bit in the event of rain. So it again, is important, I think, to keep tabs on the forecast. The ground-oriented Wildcats would certainly favor from the possibility of poor weather conditions. I just can't see Mark Stoops with the talent he's got on this team, the running game that they have, a healthy Terry Wilson at quarterback. I still think they've got a really good defense. I just can't see him going 0-3. So I'm with you. I think Kentucky minus a small number is a good play over Mississippi State on Saturday.
Yeah, look, I was on the Bulldogs in the opener against LSU. I think that was just a giant flat spot. LSU was thin in the secondary as well. I don't think, as much as I do like Costello and Leach, I don't think throwing for 600 yards on a weekly basis is something to expect from that offense. So and weather related, I do like the under there. So let's go to some of the marquee games. You're already on Florida plus the 7 because you can still get that out there. There's an interesting one with Miami and Clemson. 14 at Death Valley. Obviously, Clemson has just been trucking ACC opponents the last couple of years. This is a shorter line than we've seen in recent memory. I feel like there was like a 17 against NC State a couple of years ago that was a huge square play when they were undefeated and they had that quarterback got drafted. I forget what his name is, but they were like, this is like a legit, like, wow, they could lose. There's a chance they could lose. So what do you make of 14 here with Miami with Derek King, one of the Heisman hopefuls now with catching the points on the road at Clemson?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think the number's spot on pretty much. You know, you look at this Miami team and things have changed so much since last December. You know, they played Louisiana Tech in the Independence Bowl, lost to the Bulldogs 14-0. In that game, they had 227 yards total offense. They averaged just 3.7 yards per play. But, you know, they've had 2 additions, and I think you just mentioned one of them who have been largely responsible, I think, for the new look that they brought to the offense. And first of all, dual threat grad transfer quarterback De'Aaron King. I mean, that guy's a playmaker. He did great things at Houston, and he just brings such a dimension to the offense. I think one of the keys for a college offense is if you can have that quarterback like King who can make plays off schedule, who when things break down can make plays with his feet and head up the field. That's such a difficult thing for the defense to defend, especially when some of the defense has been dragged down the field by receivers and the field spread out and those types of things. And then in addition to De'Aaron King, you've added offensive coordinator Rhett Lashley. He may ultimately turn out to be the most important offseason assistant hire in all of college football in my mind. And so far, it's only been three games again, but with Lashley calling the shots and King running the show, the Hurricanes offense, which really previously was probably sputtering at best most of last year, has been rejuvenated. It ranks in the top 11 in all of college football in some key offensive categories, those being scoring offense, total offense, and rushing offense. And, you know, things are clearly looking up at Coral Gables. As you said, though, Clemson, this has been Clemson's league for several years now. And until things change, you know, the Tigers are the class of the ACC. So the task at hand for the Hurricanes gets exceedingly more difficult this weekend when they travel to Clemson to take on Dabo Swinney and the Tigers. You look at their last three games, though, or first three games of the season, I think, you know, Clemson's clearly taking care of business. They hadn't been threatened or anything like that. But I think it's clear to me that the Tigers probably aren't quite as imposing on defense as they have been the three previous seasons. In the previous three seasons, they've allowed less than 14 points in all three of those seasons. I don't think they're really that strong this year. They're still very good. They're still one of the best defenses in the nation. But I don't think they're quite at the level they've been. And obviously, that's an extremely high level. So I'm really interested to see what King and the Canes can do here. It's a very intriguing game. Again, you have the possibility of inclement weather to deal with. And I think that favors the two-touchdown underdog Hurricanes, especially with a veteran quarterback, if that weather should be dicey there Saturday night in Death Valley. I think Miami's going to make this game competitive. I think 14 points is a good amount of points to have in your pocket. I'm going to recommend taking Miami 14 points over Clemson Saturday night there at Death Valley.
Okay, yeah, no, I was on Clemson first half, and they were covering by 20. They were leading by 21 late, and Virginia just drove the field so quickly. I want to say like in a minute, and even a field goal I covered, and it lands 18. But gosh, maybe you're right about that defense not being as potent as it once was. But 14 is interesting. Obviously, the backdoor covers in play, but Miami's looked good. Kings looked excellent, so I can't fault you for that at all. I think it's going to be a great game, at least early on. I think that Miami's going to be so up for this. And we'll see if Clemson can get up for these games. Being at home will help, I would imagine. But it is interesting that Clemson finally has a challenge in that regard. All right, so some of the other games, not as high profile, but all tickets cash the same. Break me down on Syracuse-Duke, because I have a man crush on Cutcliffe. I love the guy, but you're going against him.
Yeah, you know, you look at this game, if it was college hoops in certain years, I think Cameron Indoor Arena or the Carrier Dome would be the place to be on Saturday. But like you said, this is kind of a little bit downstream game, so to speak. But like you said, the tickets all cash the same. So this is a game that I'm really really looking forward to seeing how it comes out. Neither one of these teams have played well to date, no question about it. They're combined 1-6 so far. That comes in conference games, each of those seven games. Syracuse's 37-20 victory over Georgia Tech, rather, a couple of weeks ago at home is the lone victory between these two teams all season. You look at Duke's four losses, three of those have been by 14 points or more. The Blue Devils' new quarterback, Clemson grad transfer Chase Bryce, already thrown seven interceptions against just three touchdown passes. Blue Devil quarterbacks have been sacked 17 times in four games. So they're having a lot of trouble offensively. I actually made Syracuse a three-point favorite in this game. If the Orange win the turnover battle at home or even come out even in the turnover battle, I think they've got a really strong opportunity to win this game outright. I think they're going to beat the Blue Devils there at the Carrier Dome on Saturday. Take the 2.5, and I think Syracuse wins this game outright over Duke.
Can't fault you at all on that one. Next game is a game that I would not have been circling. This Texas State team has played well at times. Boston College, everything they could handle, had a lead in the fourth quarter. BC came back to win. I believe that game was even on Chestnut Hill, but Texas State at Troy catching over a touchdown, 7.5 or 8.
Yeah, I mean, I think this Texas State team, they might be one of the most improved teams in all of football in the second season under head coach Jake Spavital. He was previously offensive coordinator at Cal and then West Virginia and then most recently at Texas A&M before becoming Texas State's head coach. You look at the Bobcats, I think they've got a distinct advantage, and they might be the only team. I should have researched this probably before I came on, but they played games all four Saturdays in September. I don't know how many of the 130, of course, not all the 130 FBS teams are playing right now, but I don't know how many of the teams that started the season actually were able to play all four Saturdays in September. Texas State was able to do that. They were off last week. And in their last game, as you mentioned, they led by 14 points there at Boston College late in the third quarter on the road before the Eagles rallied, got a 24-21 victory. Looking at that defense, important to note, last week Boston College played North Carolina down to the bitter end, went for two, ended up losing that game when they failed that conversion. North Carolina actually took it back for 2 points the other way, so Boston College lost by four. But against nationally ranked North Carolina in a pretty solid Tar Heel defense, Boston College averaged 4.7 yards per play last week against North Carolina. The week before, they averaged 4.6 yards per play against Texas State. So I think Texas State, along you, you know, you think of Jake Spavital, you think about offense. Their defense is what's really improved. They're playing their fifth game of the season. They've had a pretty normal season as far as the sequence and timing of their games. Troy will only be playing its third game of the season after last week's matchup against rival South Alabama was postponed to December due to coronavirus concerns. So they're only playing their third game. I think you add it all up. 7.5 points to me is a bargain. Takes Texas State in the 7.5 over Troy.
Okay. I like it. I was actually on North Carolina last week, and you can just tell from the first quarter, there's no way they were covering that 14. Just wasn't happening. BC's gotten a lot faster. At least the eye test tells me that. So the fact that Texas State had the lead in the fourth, it's a good sign, although it could have been a flat spot. Who knows? We'll see. But I do like that play. We have one other play from you, but before we get to that, I do want to mention, I'm on this Thursday night game. I like Houston laying the 6.5. You know, there was a narrative throughout the first month of the college football season that teams that have a game under their belt, it's better. And certainly I assume that as well for the first little bit, but I have to look it up. It's like 14-3 ATS, the teams that have not played yet. That's what they're doing against the spread. And I, you know, then I was like, all right, so what's the narrative the other way? And it could be just that there's no film on these teams, right? They know what they're getting with the opponent that's already played. But when a team that in 3-14-2, something like that, ATS, it's actually remarkable. So I like Houston laying the 6.5 to Tulane. I also think Tulane is kind of Jekyll and Hyde. They first half, second half against, what was it, the Army they played or Navy. I just, you know, they've been all over. I just haven't been that with Tulane. Obviously, for four quarters is what I haven't been impressed with at times there. So that trend sort of sticks out. So I'm going to ride Houston on that one. You're in Texas. What do you feel about that matchup?
You know, I'm just a little bit, and that is a very notable trend there, something you've got to take into account. But I'm a little bit concerned the fact that Houston hadn't played. I'm not a huge Dana Holgorsen fan. This game last year was the game that kind of unraveled Houston's season. You know, they went into New Orleans there. I think it was on a Thursday night and got off to a big lead, and then they ended up losing that game.
I had the dog in that one. That's right. It was a Thursday or Friday night. Just, you know, and I had 4.5. You know, they could have just tackled him, and then he'd have a field goal.
Yeah, so that was such a bitter loss. And, you know, about three days later, De'Aaron King and a couple of other players – indicated they were redshirting for the season. So they had already given up on the season. And, of course, the writing was on the wall that De'Aaron King would not be in Houston for the 2020 season. So, you know, I'll watch the game again with great interest. I think Tulane does have some quarterback issues still to work out. They started the season with Southern Miss transfer Keon Howard under center, and they've made a change. And I just don't know how good they are you know, throughout their lineup. But I'll be pulling for you. But that's a game I'll just kind of, you know, like most of them, I'll watch at least part of the game and try to get a feel for the teams. But I don't have a strong opinion from a betting standpoint on that one.
Okay, fair point. And you do have one final game for us. I'm just getting out of that. I believe it's Charlotte -3 against North Texas. I feel like I'm 0-6 betting North Texas games on them, against them. I kind of sworn them off. So enlighten our listeners.
Well, you know, first of all, Charlotte's going to be playing its third straight road game, third game of the year in a 5-game stretch. They travel to Denton, as you indicated, to play North Texas on Saturday. Last week, Charlotte was a 4.5-point underdog. They actually lost at Florida Atlantic 21-17. Charlotte led that game 10-0 at halftime, led most of the first three quarters, as a matter of fact. Looking back to their opener a couple of weeks before that, they lost their opener at Appalachian State 35-20, but they led, or actually only trailed, I should say, the Mountaineers only by 21-20 in that game at the end of three quarters. So it should be noted that, you know, Charlotte, while 0-2, they played a couple of pretty solid teams, two teams that won bowl games last year, convincingly in Appalachian State and Florida Atlantic. So their 0-2 start, not necessarily reason for alarm in my mind. In fact, I kind of like this Charlotte team. They went 7-6 last year. They lost to Buffalo in the Bahamas Bowl by a pretty large margin there. But they return a hot young commodity, a hot coach in Will Healy, who's going to be at a Power 5 program. Maybe by this time next year, certainly in the next 2 or 3 years, he'll get a Power 5 job. Almost certain of that. And they also have a veteran dual-threat quarterback in Chris Reynolds, who started 20 games at the collegiate level, so brings them a lot of experience at that position. You look at North Texas, they did win their opener over FCS member Houston Baptist, 57-31. But their last two games that they played, both at home to SMU and Southern Miss, they've lost by a combined 40 points. Last week against Southern Miss, due to COVID-19 and just other injury issues, they were without 7 key players. Some of those guys are still going to be out against Charlotte on Saturday. Also in that loss last week to previously winless Southern Miss, North Texas just made it's almost like a comedy of errors. They lost 3 fumbles. They, on a pop-up kickoff, they fumbled that and failed to recover it. They had a field goal block. So they just seem to be really missing on all cylinders, if you will, in all phases of the game. You've got a Charlotte team that almost desperately needs a win. They don't want to start 0-3. I think they're the more talented, the more experienced team. The home field, I don't think it means a whole lot in 2020. I think you take Charlotte, you lay the 3, the 49ers beat North Texas Saturday. They're in Denton.
I may have to come off the bench for this one. I think I might have to end my hiatus on North Texas. I do like Charlotte a lot. Last year I had a lot of picks on them. I like their coach. Their offense is high-powered, or at least designed to be. You might have convinced me here, Paul. I'm with you. It took all the – forget the main games. Forget the marquee games. We had to wait till Charlotte, North Texas for this one. I think you got a winner there. So, my man, it was good to connect. Hopefully we'll connect in person soon here in Las Vegas. But I know our listeners really appreciate your insight, so thanks for taking the time.
Man, I appreciate you having me on, Doug, and hope everybody has a great weekend of college football, and you take care of yourself.
After a brief hiatus, bring back the MMA boys, Lou and Matthew, back with us. And, you know, it's a good sign when my Twitter feed blows up and everyone's like, what? No UFC pod this week? I think you guys are in high demand. So, you know, take it as a feather in your cap.
I'll definitely take it as a feather in my cap, and I appreciate the listeners speaking up and appreciating you and Matthew let me chime in here on these fights.
Well, it's always so nice of you to be so deferential.
Lord, I like this main team. Event.
Good. But you lost all your computer notes, Matthew.
I did. I had a crash out this morning, so I spent several hours kind of getting my notes ready just for this show. I don't have them, so I'm going off the cuff. So watch out this week.
All right. So you can lean on us a little bit, chime in, but just kidding. You are well prepared. And I always felt like back in the college days, and even during my hosting days here at ESPN, like as I write the cards, I retain it. So a lot of people take notes that way anyway. So I bet you'll retain more. than you realize, at least short-term stuff. So let's get into it, guys. We only have a handful of fights to get through, but we have a deep dive in each of them. Obviously, the card is in Fight Island, the second of five straight fights, I believe. And this one is with Sanhagen and Marais. It's Sanhagen's a favorite of $135. And what I enjoy sometimes is having opposite sides, so which we do have here in the main event. So, Lou, why don't you explain how you feel the Sanhagen fight goes and why you like him?
He keeps letting you go first, Lou, but I think I'm undefeated against you since we started back up. A lot of pressure.
Shots fired. Well, you didn't have your notes, so I didn't want you to have to go first, right?
Well, first of all,
I appreciate it. I probably need to lean on Lou. He's probably going to talk me off listening to him.
Listen, Matthew Holt without notes is more prepared than most anyone with notes, so don't let that fool you. As far as the fight is concerned, Morris is surely the more explosive fighter. He's the more experienced fighter, and he's been in there with the better set of competition. However, he shows trends in his fights, and the trends are that the savant-like way that he strikes, his unusual spinning kicks and such, cause him to use a lot of energy. Besides, mentally, I'm not convinced he's the strongest, sturdiest tree in the forest. Once he gets tired, he fades, and he fades quickly. That's been the pattern in all his fights. He's entering this fight against Corey Sanhagen, and Sanhagen was defeated brutally by KO in his last fight against a guy that Morais knocked out in the first round. I don't believe that math equates. I don't believe Morais or Sanhagen honestly are top five competitors in this division. I think Morais is going to have to find a way to be able to fight five rounds in this fight. Sanhagen's going to be 5 inches the taller man. He's 4 years younger. He's a switch stance fighter. He's coming out of the Elevation Fight Team, which his last fight, Matthew made a big deal out of Elevation, and it should be a big deal. He'll as well have 3 inches of reach, arms and legs against Morais. Sanhagen's going to have to weather a furious first 7 minutes from Morais, but once this fight gets into the third round and goes later, I see Sanhagen, who's going to be plenty focused and wants to get the taste of that bitter defeat out of his mouth, will start to take this fight. And while he may look ugly or give a round or two away early, I look for Sanhagen, once this third round starts, to completely take over the fight. And the key will be that he has to get to the third round. I like Sanhagen as a short favorite in this fight.
So, you know, what's interesting is I did an analysis this past week because this main event got me thinking is, what is the importance of athleticism in MMA? And I just started with, let me get all the champions and the top five contenders in each division, just according to the UFC rankings. And when you look at the champions in each division, Stipe Miocic, not the most athletic guy in the world, although pretty athletic. Jan Blachowicz at light heavyweight, certainly another Eastern European guy, not the most athletic guy. Adesanya at middleweights, and Kamaru Usman at welterweight are kind of the two exceptions because they're so athletic, unbelievably, both of them. And Usman really relies on his athleticism. But again, we get down to 155. While Khabib is an unbelievable wrestler, sambo specialist, not the most athletic guy in the world. Alexander Volkanovski at 145, not the most athletic guy in the world. The champion in this division, Peter Yan, not the most athletic guy in the division, yet, you know, a dominant champion right now. So I started to think maybe the idea that Marais is a better athlete doesn't really mean that much in this fight. But the reason I ended up leaning on Marlon Marais in this fight, two things really got my attention here. Number one, and you talked about it, the strength of schedule. But number two, at the end, just watching this fight in particular, because I thought Marlon Marais, based on the fact that he's fought so many top contenders, knocked out Aljamain Sterling, who defeated Corey Sandhagen in the first round, knocked out Jimmy Rivera, who's basically been unfinishable besides that in the bantamweight division, choked out Rafael Assuncao in their fight. I thought the Jose Aldo fight was a little bit of a misnomer, because the problem with Jose Aldo is that he looks really good for two and a half rounds and then fades. But because of Aldo fighting in so many events, what we've seen from Aldo in two fights versus Max Holloway and then the fight versus Peter Yan, which, oh, by the way, go back and watch rounds 2, 1, and 2 of all three of those fights, and Aldo looked great. He fades badly. So a three-round fight for Aldo when he fought Marlon Moraes, and it was a split decision in his last, I could forgive Moraes for not having a great performance there, because nobody has great performances against Jose Aldo in rounds 1 and 2. But at the end of the day, I just think if, you know, what's going to happen in this fight, because Corey Sandhagen, even in the fights he wins, takes a lot of damage. This guy is kind of a road warrior out there, you know, take shots and come back and finish fights. And we saw that in fights with like Austin Arnett. And who's Austin Arnett? That's right. And, you know, Corey Sandhagen came back and knocked him out. Uriel Alcantara, the John Lineker fight where he had a split decision where he ate plenty of damage. Sandhagen is a warrior and he's tough and he's never been knocked out. But I also think he's really hittable and he hasn't faced a lot of strikers the level of Marlon Moraes, who's already fought for a title. He's basically fought everyone there is except Peter Yan in the top 10 in the bantamweight division. I think at plus money, they probably have the wrong guy favored here. I don't love this. It wasn't one of my favorite plays, but I just couldn't come up with a good reason why I should be laying money with Corey Sandhagen against a much more accomplished fighter, a much more accomplished striker, a better athlete. Yeah, at the end of the day, I respect the fact that Corey Sandhagen fights for a great gym over there in Denver, Colorado. They've been really putting it together. But I just think he's a little hittable. And that could spell disaster against a guy like Marlon Moraes, who has 10 knockouts in 23 fights and has shown something that a lot of people don't have the ability to do at 135 pounds, which is literally one strike knock people out, like he did to Jimmy Rivera in the first round, like he did to Aljamain Sterling in the first round. This guy really comes out on fire. A guy like Corey Sandhagen, who's hit, it's not just about giving round one away. I think he might get put away in the first round. I took the short plus money with Marlon Moraes.
Look at this guy. No notes needed. None. Question for you. The over-under in this one's 3.5. And Lou, you were talking about, oh, he's got to weather 7 minutes. I mean, that's a lot to do in a fight. Now, I know the main event, we've talked about how these trends, this has been trending over in the main event, the bigger octagon, and trying to pace themselves for 5 rounds. But, Matthew, it sounds like you like under 3.5 here, -110.
I'll tell you, I think I tend to favor overs in main events because there's so much on the line for these guys financially. This fight's no different. The winner of this fight is going to be right there to fight for the bantamweight title or at least have another big fight at bantamweight. And the great thing about bantamweight is there's lots of really popular, well-known, well-established fighters. Bantamweight is loaded. So that means more main event spots and more money. So there's a lot on the line in this main event. But I just think their fighting style, Corey Sandhagen being so easy to hit, Marlon Moraes coming out so explosive. And I do agree with Lou in that if Marlon Moraes doesn't really do big time damage in the first couple of rounds, he's going to start to fade and be in trouble. But again, that also lends itself to him potentially being finished himself in round 3 or so. I couldn't touch this total. If I had to pick a side on the total, I would probably lean under.
And if I may,
what about you, Lou?
Yeah, I have strong feelings. First of all, Sandhagen lands 7 significant strikes a minute, and he gets 4 significant strikes landed upon him. Moraes lands 3.5 significant strikes a minute and gets 3.8 which is almost four, landed on him. Morais is going to have dynamic difficulty managing Sandhagen's physical size, length, and movement. And as far as the over-under is concerned, if you like Morais, surely I think you have to feel that the under is the way you would want to go. But since I don't like Morais, I lean to Sandhagen here. I definitely think that it's an over 3.5 if you're in the Sandhagen camp.
Interesting. All right. Okay, because I was reading between the lines that it was an under, but I'm glad I flushed it out with you guys. Let's go to the next card. Barbosa is such a popular fighter. I've tried to fade him a couple times and it didn't work out so well for me. So he's minus 250-ish and against Amir Khani. So this is a very exciting fight, guys, with a lot of hype. And I don't want to use hype as a negative connotation. I think it's a positive connotation. So a lot of buzz. But what do you make of this matchup, Matthew?
Look, I think Amir Khani is one of these guys. There are very few times that we see submission artists in MMA get a lot of love. And Amir Khani's suddenly been doing that lately. He has an interesting nickname, Mr. Finland. He has a lot of charisma. He goes for the finish all the time. And a lot of his finishes come early, as a lot of submission guys do. And he's actually pretty fun to watch. His kryptonite, though, is Ben Strikers, and we saw it two fights back for him against Shane Burgos, where he got knocked out, where if he can't get that submission game, that ground game going, he could really get dominated, hurt, and stopped on the feet sometimes, and Edson Barbosa, obviously, is one of those guys that can do that. I feel like this is a situation where the UFC is trying to help out Edson Barbosa. You know, Dana White said, and most people agree, that Edson Barbosa should have got the nod in that decision against Dan Ige. He didn't. Ige went on to get a main event slot that probably should have been Barbosa's. That means real money to Barbosa. I think the UFC is trying to set him up in a spot where if you're really still at the top of your game, Edson Barbosa, and there's a lot of question marks whether he is or not, but if he is, this is a guy that he should be able to get out of there. And the reason I left this fight alone is, while I agree that Amir Khani is tailor-made for Edson Barbosa on the feet, Edson Barbosa tends to fade in fights nowadays. 34 years old, been in way too many wars, lost 5 of his last 6 fights. A little bit of this line at this point is built on reputation rather than actual matchup here. I mean, how often do you see a guy who's lost 5 of 6, a minus 250 favorite against anybody? I'm a little bit nervous about what Edson Barbosa has left in the tank. And how many times have we seen guys go on these losing streaks, try to switch divisions, have a little bit of success, a.k.a. Cowboy Cerrone, a.k.a. Rafael Dos Anjos, a.k.a. Anthony Showtime Pettis, where they have some success, but it's never sustained success, flipping between weight divisions. Diego Sanchez, who just fought at welterweight, but 2 fights before that fought at featherweight. They're just trying something because at the end of their career, things aren't working. So for me, I actually think Amir Khani could be live late in this fight if he can weather the storm early, which is the early striking game of Edson Barbosa, and get a tired Barbosa in the second half of this fight. I think he could get the finish via submission here. I didn't play this one yet, but it's certainly a possibility that I may by fight night. And if I do, I'm certainly going to be taking the dog, Amir Khani here, Mr. Finland, around plus 220.
What about you, Luke?
Edson Barbosa was scheduled to fight a really flashy, high-end competitor in the featherweight division named Yusuf. That fight got canceled. Yusuf had to be replaced, and Amir Khani steps in on short notice against Barbosa. Barbosa's lost 5 of his last 6, but it was in the higher division at lightweight, and it was against guys like Khabib Nurmagomedov. Oh, he's the champion. Justin Gaethje. Oh, he's the guy going to fight the champion. Paul Felder, Kevin Lee, those 4 fighters right there so far exceed anything that Amir Khani's even dreamed about, that I believe that Amir Khani's showing a lot of chutzpah jumping in to take this fight, but he's going to get absolutely completely dominated in this fight. Barboza should be the big favorite. If I were to bet the fight, I'd bet Barboza inside the distance at plus 115. But it's a pass for me. I see no way Amir Khani should be in the same octagon as Barboza.
Wow. Strong word. Lou, do you have a counter to this? Look at, you know, I'm like the regular Mike Wallace here. What about your counter?
That's interesting, the plus 115. Well, I'm with Lou. I passed right now, but I actually agree because I agree that, look, Amir Khani on the feet is tailor-made for Edson Barboza. So why not play this thing both sides? Edson Barboza inside the distance at a small plus, Amir Khani just to win, because, or Amir Khani by sub, because he's not knocking out Edson Barboza, obviously, and he's probably not winning a decision. Amir Khani by sub is basically the only way he wins. So you take a shot on Edson Barboza by inside the distance or by knockout, because that's probably how this is going to go. Amir Khani's not great on the feet. And on the other side, you can get two, you know, plus two and a third, or two and a half to one on Amir Khani just to win, because Edson Barboza fades. He faded badly in that Dan Ige fight. We all agree he won the first two rounds and should have won the decision 2-1. But he was getting mopped up in the third round by Dan Ige, a small featherweight, who then turned around and got mopped up in his next fight at a main event. So I'm so on the Edson Barboza performances. Yeah, look, everybody forgave the Khabib and Justin Gaethje losses, but the Kevin Lee knockout loss hasn't aged very well, as I can't remember the last time Kevin Lee beat anybody. You know, he didn't look great. I mean, the Paul Felder fight, which was tailor-made, two kickboxers going at it, was close, but I just think Barboza at this point, he's certainly a deserving big favorite, but he's also on the wrong side of the mountain, the wrong side of the peak of his mountain. The featherweight, he has to cut a lot of weight to get down to featherweight. We saw it in the fight against Dan Ige, and people talked about betting Ige in that fight. I bet Barboza and lost the decision. I should have won, but I will say this, it's a big weight cut for Edson Barboza to get down to 145, and that showed in the later rounds of that fight, where he ended the last round being dominated in that last round because he ran out of gas. If he runs out of gas again in this fight, that's Amir Khani's one and only shot. Catch him in a submission there. I like the double plus. I like Lou's angle. I could certainly see Barboza banging him out quick, and if I can get plus money there, great. And I could certainly see Amir Khani late in the fight against the fatigued, drained Edson Barboza catching him in a sub.
I will add, if I may, that weight is really critical to this fight. And Barboza, since he did fight at 55 his whole career, has only had one fight at 45. That was against Dan Ige. And in all due respect, I believe Ige won that fight. Barboza lost the second, lost the third decisively. But again, these differences of opinion are good. I just believe that the Barboza weight cut to 45, because it worked in the fight against Ige, doesn't mean it's going to be easy for him in this fight. So anyone interested in this fight has to wait for weigh-ins to see how Barboza looks trying to get to 145 again.
Agreed.
All right, good. I like it. Flushing it out. Solid stuff on that front. Next card, you guys are, I believe, on the similar similar play, if I remember, with Rothwell here is a minus -165. Just going through my notes. And what about Matthew? Why don't you start us with that one?
I think Lou and I are probably thinking the same thing in this fight, and for some reason, initially, when I bet this fight, I didn't want to lay the minus 155 with an aging Ben Rothwell. So I ended up playing this fight inside the distance, under 2.5 rounds, plus 150. I just couldn't ignore that plus 150. Look, I think at the end of the day, Marcin Tybura, when he wins fights, they are the most boring wins you've ever seen. He has to get you up against the fence, or he has to get the fight to the ground. He just doesn't have that ability to stand up with the elite, or at least, you know, the better heavyweights. And he's starting to age at 34, and that ability to stand up is getting worse and worse. 19-6 for Ty Bora. Four of the six losses are by knockout. He just cannot handle big punchers. And it's not all big punchers knocking him out. Shabil Abdurakhimov knocked him out. Augusto Saki got him out of there in a minute. Derek Lewis, Fabricio, you know, older guys. So this is a guy who tends to get knocked out. His last three losses are all by knockout, and 28 of 38 wins for Ben Rothwell are by knockout. This is a guy who, while he has an accomplished wrestling pedigree, tends to knock people out. And I think Ben Rothwell is going to be able to use that accomplished ground pedigree he has just to keep this fight standing and then do what he does when he wins fights, which is land big shots, put an end to a guy who tends to get knocked out anyway in Marcin Tybura. So I lean Rothwell pretty heavy, but I had to lay 155 with Rothwell. I got plus 160 that the fight doesn't basically under 2.5 rounds, so that the fight doesn't go the distance. And I think if Rothwell wins, in most scenarios, he probably wins by knockout in this fight. So I went ahead and took under 2.5 rounds, plus 150, rather than laying the minus 155 with Ben Rothwell.
What do you think, Matt, Lou?
I think that's a very concise breakdown of how I feel on this fight. I don't know that I feel strong enough on the under to go that way. I'm going to go ahead and swallow hard and bet Rothwell at the favorite price just to win the fight. I don't believe Tybura is his level of fight class. And I really think he's a fringe UFC fighter. I think Rothwell wins this fight. That's why I'll take him.
Interesting. All right. So you, Lou, I mean, you're usually not a guy loading up on favorites, but here you are with Rothwell, and then you obviously like Barbosa, but that Barbosa into the distance for the plus money. What does it take that much for you to sway you to the, not sway you, but allow you to overcome your apprehension for favorites?
It takes value. And I think Sandhagen, I mean, he opened 150. Why don't we trust our bookmaker? He's now minus 130. So I'm getting the best of the number at Sandhagen now. Rothwell opened 150. He's right at 155. And really, I mean, if Mike Tyson and me got in a fight and Tyson was minus 2,000, that's value. And so I'm taking it. And I believe Rothwell at minus 155 is value, and I have to let value determine my decisions and not whether it's a dog or a favorite.
It's funny, the analogy we usually use is the Mayweather Conor McGregor, right? Because the value is all in the favorite. But I like the Tyson Finocchiero matchup too. Maybe I'll use that on Daily Wager later today. I think that's a good reference point for all bettors. No, I know what you mean. And that's something, you know, we've talked about it on this podcast with other sports and stuff as we try to educate some of our newer listeners as legalization expands to other states. And obviously we want to be inclusive to the people who are more proficient maybe in the space, but we also want to be inclusive to the newbies. And that is the thing. You hear the value term, and look, our mutual friend Matt Humans said a line that I've hijacked over the years is I got a lot of tickets of value in my trash, right? I mean, like a lot of these dogs you take that you're like, oh, plus 350, and they never had a chance. You're like, what the F? So value comes in all shapes and sizes. Yeah, and you can have value and lose, right? I mean, there's a reason. You're not taking it a pick when it's a dog. You're taking it like plus 350 in this example. So sometimes it doesn't hit, and sometimes they're good bets that don't hit. And you're saying this is a good bet with value. You're not saying it's the absolutely free lock of the year with five stars and all that, but you just like the play. And I think that's things that people need to remember and grind. One thing I heard someone say, and Lou, I'll ask you, when you lay the favorite, do you risk the same amount? Like, let's just use $100, for example. If you're doing 100 on a plus 130, it's 100 to win 130. Do you do like 155 to win 100, or do you do 100 to win whatever it is, 40,
yeah, 45? Yeah, I always outlay a unit, and I always try and win a unit. Now, in a case of a favorite, for instance, Adesanya, a week ago, what I wrote up was, besides using Adesanya inside the distance, I used him minus 170 in the front leg of a parlay. That allows me to use the favorite, but still only outlay one unit of measure. But I have to team him up with someone later in the line. And in this particular case, I teamed Sandhagen this week with Adesanya 2 weeks ago.
Gotcha. What about you, Matthew?
I always try to keep it the same. Same as Lou. If I'm going to bet to win $100, then I'm lay. If it's -155, I lay the -155. And I think if you don't do that, and in the long run, it's really hard to keep track of how you're doing. And look, I think every single person that's ever talked intelligently to people, you know, when you're talking to new people getting into the space, always starts with money management. Yeah, I know. I have some friends. We've had people come in the office that are analysts for us that haven't bet before, but they're so unbelievable at analyzing data that they can learn the betting part of it. And I'll see them betting like $10 or $20 parlays because they don't want to bet a lot. And I always tell them, look, if you want to bet $10 a bet, awesome. That's cool. Bet $10 a bet. Don't feel like because you're only betting $10 that you suddenly have to bet parlays. I said, make every one of your bets $10. And if 6 months from now you're like, hey, wow, I'm up $130, move your bet size to $20 or whatever you're comfortable with as your bet size, could, you know, in terms of your available wagering bankroll. But money management is always the key. If you start messing with your bet size, oh, there's a 100 million star lock and you're betting a 20X. When you lose those bets, they're bankroll killers, right? So whether you're betting $5 or $5,000 a bet, it doesn't matter, really. Just make your straight bets, all either for the layout amount being the same or two win amount being the same.
That is outstanding advice.
I agree. One of the sharpest college basketball bettors I know bets like $50 or $100. He has a job that doesn't make a lot. And, you know, we all, I mean, guys, what is it like 53.1% is break even on assuming -110. So
52.38.
So like, I mean, if you're like 58%, you're like a zillion, you know, you can crush it. I mean, yeah. Or we're saying the overs were 29 and 19 going into last weekend's NFL. And they obviously put more overs than unders again. So it's just a grind. I mean, there's no absolutely free lot, whatever. Star, somebody told me this a long time ago. Stars belong in the sky. Locks belong on doors. You know, it's just you can't overdo it. Now, you can kind of do a 1.25 unit sometimes if you're like, sure, really love it. You're like, you know, a handful of plays a year. And then, you know, I was heavy on the Lakers money line last night. Things like that. I did some of it parlayed with the Storm money line, even though I like both against the spread. Storm got there, won by 30+, but the Lakers got, you know, backdoor covered. So I just think it's all about management. And some of the best guys, unless you get a guy who can bankroll you, it's hard to take the leap in terms of your size, your bet unit size. And so that's why people get in, you know, kind of partner up with other people, get in the syndicate stuff. So there's just but Matthew, you hit it out of the park in terms of your analysis and your advice on that front. So good insight there as we keep it moving here. I want to get to some of the other, I know you guys have plays on the other cards. One more play on the main card. That's Perez and Duplessis. And I think, Matthew, you have a play on that, right?
Yeah, I took the over here. Over 2.5 rounds plus 140 is what I got. Over 2.5 rounds plus 140. As the odds were 2.5 rounds under -150 when I played it last night. I think they're still around that now. This is an interesting scenario. So Marcus Perez and Duplessis have a lot in common. Perez came into the UFC undefeated, 10-0, a lot of hype, owned a win over Ian Heinisch, who's a former who still is a UFC fighter. Beat Paulo Thiago, who's a former UFC fighter. I mean, he came in with as much hype as we have seen somebody come in to the UFC in a long time. And he's gone 2-3 in the UFC. You know, he's more of a ground specialist. It hasn't translated. He's fought some big, strong guys. He couldn't get to the ground like Andrew Sanchez and Eric Anders. And at the end of the day, he kind of reminds me of Duplessis. Now, Duplessis isn't as hyped as Marcus Perez coming into the UFC, but this is a guy who's 14-2, dominated the regional scene, and now makes his UFC debut. and tends to do most of his work on the ground. Nine submissions and 14 wins for Duplessis. And he's a smaller guy here. So what's interesting is the favorite is the naturally smaller guy. Duplessis has fought the majority of his fights, or at least a lot of them, at 170 pounds. He's going to give up a two and a half inch height advantage, multiple inch reach advantage in this fight. So Perez is going to be taller, longer, naturally bigger, kind of in the same situation as Duplessis in terms of coming into the UFC with a ton of hype. I think there's actually some value on Marcus Perez as well. And there's a pretty good chance I end up having some type of a wager on Perez by the time I get to fight night. I just want to see how these two look because, again, it's not a natural 185er versus 185er pairing. So I'm interested to see the weigh-in. But the one thing I do know is a lot of times when you get two ground guys like this who are good in submissions but not submission whizzes, is a lot of times it turns into a slow one-strike-at-a-time kickboxing match. They both know the other one's really good on the ground, and we've seen it time and time again. You put two great wrestlers in there. The wrestling negates each other. It turns into a slower one-strike-at-a-time kind of kickboxing match. And in the bigger octagon, I could really see that being the case here in the 30-foot octagon rather than the 25-foot octagon. So I took a shot that these two made it over 2.5 rounds at plus 140.
Interesting. All right, good. And let's go to the undercard. You guys are both on, I'm looking at the ESPN.com layout, so it may not be the first one, but the last prelim before the main card, and that's Bular. I'll let you go first, Lou. Why are you on the dog there? Plus 210.
Bular is a Canadian fighter that's been in the regional scene for some time. He has been really chomping at the bit to get his opportunity for the UFC. And about just over 2 weeks ago, he got the call for 1 week notice to fight Tom Breeze, which was supposed to be held last week. And for whatever reason, that fight got postponed from last week to this week. And so Bular, who had a short notice, 10-day notice for a fight, now almost doubles his preparation time. He's hungry, and he's the taller fighter, and I don't have reach on him. So I'm a little bit – I've only seen him fight once. He trains with the heavyweight Boser in Canada, so he comes from a good camp. And while I'm prepared to bet Bular in this fight, it's maybe not as much – on why I like Bular, but maybe a little bit more on a fade of his opponent, Tom Breeze. Breeze looks the part. Big, huge, muscular, chiseled 6'3", 185-pound athlete. He's a lefty. He's from the UK, so he's typical of British fighters, somewhat erect, straight up and down, and a striker. The biggest issue with Breeze is his inactivity. He's fought maybe 10 times in 12 years. He struggles tremendously mentally preparing for fights and getting over the anxiety to go out to the octagon. He's had more than one fight canceled because of anxiety. For that reason, I can never count on Tom Breeze showing up inside the cage 100% ready to go. However, in this case, with the young debuting fighter chomping at the bit, dying to get in there, I know he's coming with his best, and he's gotten a little extra preparation to help him, whereas Breeze has had an extra week to think about it. Now, I may be twisting this the wrong way, but I believe that Bular at plus 215, a hungry young athlete like he is, I think he's in a very good spot to make a name for himself. And I think that this is as much a fade of Breeze as it is a bet on Bular.
I like that side as well. I already played Bular plus 210. And I love the fact that he trains at that Shaved Bears MMA. You know, I used to make fun of Tanner Boser when he first came into the UFC. I'm like, what kind of gym name is Shaved Bears? But Tanner Boser has been awesome in 2020 at heavyweight. These are some gritty guys coming out of that Shaved Bears gym. I like what I'm seeing for the guys coming out of this gym. And Lou's right. This guy's 28. He's a big guy for 185. I mean, Bueller's 6'4" to be fighting at 185. Just a big giant guy who I know is coming from a gym and is sparring. And he was a sparring partner for Bozer, who's a smaller heavyweight, at helping him prep for some of his fights because Bueller's 6'4". And Bozer's helping him prepare for Tom Breeze. That can only help Bueller, especially as good as Bozer's looked in his fights. And there's so many reasons, I think, to as Lou kind of alluded to say Tom Breeze is just inconsistent. You don't know what you're getting with him. He's definitely had the anxiety issues. Yeah, his last fight, he got knocked out. Tom Breeze hasn't defeated a fighter under the age of 40 since 2016 when he beat Keita Nakamura. A lot of reasons to like Bueller here. This line's way too inflated, I think, and I took the plus 210 as well. I'm with Lou.
All right. Firing on the underdog. I like it. Now, and just talking to you before we started taping, Matthew, I would say your best play is the next one, or your favorite play, I should say, is the next one I'm going to ask you about, and that's a total on the Nascimento fight.
Yeah, you know, and this is something, you know, we're kind of talking about betting theory to people. And, you know, one of the issues outside of money management, which seems obvious, that people always kind of the trap people fall into is you bet on a fighter, that fighter wins. In his next fight, you don't want to bet against him because you have some type of emotional attachment to a guy that you bet on and he won for you. You know, in the world of betting, you can never have those emotional attachments. Interestingly enough, in this fight, I bet on both of these guys. On this show, on this podcast, we gave out Nascimento as a dog in his last fight. We called exactly what would happen, that he would get the fight to the ground, get the submission win, and he did. And we bet on Chris Daukaus in his last fight as a small dog, saying that he would get the first round knockout against Parker Porter, and he did. So I think we have a pretty good feel of these two guys. And what did we say about Chris Daukaus back then when he fought Parker Porter? Is he's got to get it done in the first round. Chris Daukaus, we talked about athleticism earlier on this podcast. Chris Daukaus might be the opposite of athleticism. This is a portly young man who doesn't look like an athlete in there, but throws bombs. 8 of his 9 wins coming by knockout. 11 of his 12 career fights have not made it out of round 2. He hasn't seen a round 3 since 7-8 fights ago. This is a guy who tends to get it done early, or has it get done to him early. His one loss in his last 9 fights for Chris Daukaus, he was knocked out because he didn't get the knockout in the first round, and he was so gassed he could barely stand to get off the stool coming out of round 2 and got knocked out right away. Nascimento, the same. 6 of his 8 career fights ending in round 1. The other 2 fights that didn't ended in round 2. He's never had a fight go over 1.5 rounds. I'm not trying to buck that trend. I'm going to go ahead and lay a small price here at minus 150 that this fight ends in less than 7.5 minutes of fight time.
I like it. I'm sold. And there was one more. Is that who was on the Cortez fight?
I have Cortez, and I think Lou has.
All right, so why don't you go
Omar
with
Morales?
You're rolling. Why don't you go with Cortez the over there?
Yeah, this is a big price to lay, and it's another one of those fights where by fight night I may be on Stephanie Yeager. I really don't like her skill level in this fight, but she is going to be the significantly larger fighter in the octagon. So the over on this fight, I had to lay minus $2. But at this point, I think that it's a fairly good value. Tracy Cortez, who fights out of a good gym in Arizona and is starting to put it together, looks like she probably belongs in the UFC, only has 2 finishes and 8 career fights anyway, 1 knockout, 1 submission. They both came a while ago. All of her fights in kind of the bigger organizations, Invicta and UFC, where she's won 4 times, have all been by decision. She's 5'5", Tracy Cortez, and normally fights in the 125-pound division, and she's not a big girl for 125. Stephanie Egger, on the other hand, experience level's really low. She's 5'1", 5'7", fought at 145 pounds in her most recently in her last couple of fights. So 20 pounds higher than Tracy Cortez has been fighting. But what makes me nervous is the level of competition for Stephanie Egger. She does have one fight ever in a major organization. That came in Evicta, and it's also her only career loss. Three of her six career fights actually came in events hosted by her gym. So she trains at Buddy Gym in Switzerland. And I think three of her career fights come in like Buddy Gym 1, Buddy Gym 2, and Buddy Gym 3, where she was on the cards that that gym put on. So her level of competition is really soft here. But again, she's going to be the significantly larger fighter, which probably means she's going to be sturdy enough to hang in there. Even if Tracy Cortez's skill set is probably much better in this fight. And for that reason, I went ahead and laid the big price, minus 200, that this one goes over 2.5 rounds.
Okay. So that's not huge juice, all things considered, to be fair. So that's all right. Yeah. And our last undercard play, and you're on undefeated Morales. He's $145, Lou. He's 10-0 here in the UFC.
That's correct. He's 10-0. He's fighting a kid in Chikadze who has been active lately and is getting all, and he's looked good, but he's looked good against short, slight competition at 145 pounds that isn't quite, it's surely not top 15 level. In fact, his last win against Erwin Rivera was a short notice stand-in fighter. Meanwhile, Morales from Venezuela steps in. And the biggest part to this handicap for me is that not a lot of people know who Morales is. He's 10-0, and really he's been fighting at 155, and he's accomplished success at 155. For this fight, he takes a step down to 145. So just like Barboza and Mirakani, this is a fight that I'm going to be contingent on the weigh-ins. As soon as I make sure that Omar Morales steps on that scale 145 with no problems, he's the more durable fighter. He's fought the better competition. And I think he's just a thicker, more impressive specimen, a more well-rounded fighter than Chikadze, who's getting a little bit of recency bias off how he's looked in his last few fights. I believe that this fight was priced correctly at openers when Morales came minus 205. Now you can catch a minus 145. So there's been action on Chikadze that I disagree with, and I'll be happy to take Morales at the lower price, minus 145 in this fight.
You know, I looked at this fight, and I think Lou's on the right track here. I think part of the love for Giga Chikadze here was the fact that he was supposed to fight Alex Caceres in his last fight. And if we remember how good Caceres looked in dethroning an undefeated 19-year-old prospect in his last fight, stylistically, Giga Chikadze versus Alex Caceres was going to be a really fun fight. These are two guys that are super tall for the division. Chikadze's 6 foot fighting at 145. And they both have that creative striking. One of them is called Ninja. The other one's Bruce Leroy. That fight was going to, was so highly anticipated, and that he was getting the action in that fight, Chikadze, that I think there's some carryover effect. I think Lou's right that, you know, that fight got canceled, and now all of a sudden Chikadze finds himself in a very different type of fight against a really strong, shorter guy who's going to want to get it to the ground and ground and pound him. And this style certainly doesn't fight Ninja Chikadze's style as much as Alex Caceres would have fit in with him. So I agree. I think some of the love for Chikadze here is just the recency that he's been in the news. He had a really fun fight booked on the card that got canceled. So people remember his name and they don't know who Omar Morales is. And now that the lines come way down, maybe at plus, you know, 180 or something, I could see maybe taking Chikadze, but now it's down to plus 125, plus 130. But I think at that price, Lou's right, Morales is probably the only one with value at this point.
All right, gentlemen. Great stuff as always. I know our listeners appreciate it. I want to thank you for spending the time. And I, Matthew, I know that feeling all too well of losing losing my notes and stuff, not saving. So I sympathize with you. I appreciate your efforts across the board, and you as well, Lou. So, gentlemen, enjoy the fights. Good luck, and thanks again.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, and good luck this weekend. Take care.
Good luck to everyone.
Kicking is for losers.
Okay, so thanks to Matthew and Lou, and also thanks to Paul Stone. A lot of insight on this podcast. It was a heavy one. It was a beefy one, but hopefully everyone was able to glean some wisdom and hopefully some winning picks. So thanks to everyone for downloading, rating, reviewing, subscribing, and all that fun stuff. And we'll see you back here tomorrow with Mr. Murray.